stuff. So I'd love to hear other comments. I certainly haven't cornered the market on how to do these things.
When we do engage publics, they're doing it with their own particular values and shape of what we have and how we do this. And often we're asking people to put a lot of light on the consequence of what we're proposing from an independent perspective. And I'm curious about how you would deal with this, or how we as a program might deal with the responsibility that we have toward those who are accepting
suggestion. Could you go on a little bit more? Give an example, maybe.
Okay. I've been involved in things where you had the most wonderful idea for something and pushed it. And at some point, you have to wonder or saw the empirical evidence that maybe it wasn't so great for everybody. Some gain, some loss, in the sense of what our responsibility was to those in either direction for suggesting a rationale that altered their lives, perhaps in very bad ways. So how we deal with contextualizing our work and our outreach in the context of what people really want to be. It's contrasted with what we think is good for them. I think it goes beyond just listening. There's a certain ethical development that has to develop. I'm not sure we've come close to that.
I'd like to kind of pull us into maybe more of the avenues and the now. What mechanisms are, what is helping facilitate where we go with participation? And maybe you can kind of touch upon that, like, you know, the BP agreement is kind of a neat example, because you have an initiative by a corporation that's kind of trying to prompt direction and participation of the academic world into their own, you know, contract of their initiative to alternative fuels. There's definitely issues behind that. Then you also be approached by someone like World Wildlife Fund or Conservation Society. So maybe a little dialogue on that. Actual avenues.
Well, I was just going to respond a little bit, but by referring to Gretchen's amoeba principle, pseudopod idea, that, you know, maybe if you throw out a lot of different ideas and try to engage with stakeholders in various ways, some of those are just not going to fly, because there isn't enough will coming from the people that are involved to make it happen, and others will fly. So you sort of have the ideas that are, that the time is ripe for and really do meet the needs of some set of people are going to flourish and the other ones aren't. It seems like that's sort of what that principle is. And that might be a way of sorting out, not a perfect way, but
yeah, I guess I was asking for a specific example, because in my own career, I don't think I've had the power to harm people the way it seemed you were suggesting in, you know, imposing some grand diabolical scheme that was going to benefit some and hurt others. And so maybe I'm missing what you're getting at, but...
It's not that
okay.
It's really quite real. So, for example, I've been involved in something called really work toward developing relations with government people in cancer and land, and where in many situations the conditions do matter. In many situations, you might find that the needs of the gene benefits of that kind of arrangement, where people previously had access to some things that have lost access and are perhaps injured by this, or involved in the rural development programs. She acted, which was an attempt to mobilize activity at local level firms, where key actors that were assassinated on one side or the other, where the connection between the assassinations and what she was pushing have to come home to. I don't think it's a matter of I don't think it's a matter of sort of large-scale conspiracy, but the way the world works, the complexities of the world capture the simplicities of our ideas in ways that we can never really anticipate. And they really challenge the judgments that we need to apply and how we frame approaches of attack.
I think I see where you're coming from more clearly, and I guess still I've led a relatively boring life. I invited Terry Carl in our political science department to speak in one of my classes on Wednesday, and she sort of blew us all away with stories of, she works on the political economy of oil-producing states, among other things, and the murder and things like that are pretty commonplace in her world, whereas in what Claire and I are pretty uniform to have up here together, maybe, but in what we do, it's very much in a participatory process kind of framework, and we can't go out and bring about any of these changes ourselves. It's more, we're just a couple little people in a much broader dialogue and bringing new tools maybe to the table, but whether they're used at all and how they're used isn't really so much up to us. Maybe I don't mean to be shirking blame for things, but I haven't seen anything bad happen. Louise looks like she has something on.
I'll just say that I think that I can relate to what you're saying, because in the park project that I was involved with, there was certainly a lot more than me behind that park project. There was USAID funding and Madagascar government support, and we were trying to do this with local people, with local people's approval, and we had to go through many steps of government and governance to get the park through. But still, I think that the whole framework that we were bringing to the table was the conservation framework, and the local people, because they were largely aware that they were not that they didn't have legal tenure to their land, and that they were actually doing illegal things within the framework of their own country's laws by cutting forest, they didn't raise many objections. So I think that that was not a fully participatory process. So I think that, I think that what Gretchen's saying is that, the projects that she's engaged in now and the projects I'm engaged in now are more participatory. But I think I see that duality. A lot of times organizations, nonprofit organizations, come in with an agenda, and they're then trying to work with stakeholders, but still to meet a certain agenda. And I've always wondered about that. And how do you, I think that's, this is the territory you're talking about, is that you've got an agenda, and it's going to have some positives for some people and some negatives for other people. And sort of how do you walk that fine line between pushing your own agenda and looking out for everybody else's agenda? I think it's really difficult. So I don't have any answers at all. Louise wanted to say something.
And one of the things that actually charities can do for you is help you understand and identify those unanticipated problems. And so he is a real people. I'm just afraid that I want everyone to get excited. If you can do truly evil things with a deeply pure heart, and never know that you didn't. And that's the danger, and all of us, myself included, in the field, can do not bear the consequences of what we do. Our children don't die, we don't get driven off land, we don't get assassinated. I've just heard horror stories about the TNC at Tampa 2 weeks ago. And so I think Jeff's point about thinking beyond what about power relationship, the authority system. Do you say, well, if I was holding hands with USA, any of us would say, you are holding hands with USA, and I would say, well, we're looking at your problem. Or the bank. So,
good thing. I'm just getting everyone so clear about that. but I think it's being really mindful so that when, and on the other hand, Gretchen, I met Adam Davis, who read your book, David, and he said, it changed my life. All of a sudden, I understood about ecosystem services, and then I mean, changed the way, and you're his guru. I think you probably know that. But we really have to think about what are we doing? What are we doing for people at the
I don't know if we'll want to carry this conversation further. I'd love to hear from others on that. I have kind of a Buddhist philosophy about things, and I share the perspective you're offering. And I guess in everything, what I hope is that there's enough opportunity to iterate and to build in sort of flexibility in the work we're engaged in to change as we go along and understand better while looking as broadly as we can at what the implications are of each little step, that we can move away from missteps and hopefully keep to a good path. I don't know, what I'm always looking for is a practical way of implementing the philosophy you're talking about and of steering clear of the worries you've laid out. I stay awake at night worrying about all the things that could go wrong by proposing new institutions for making this, alignment of economic forces with the environment. I realize there are a lot of things that can go wrong, and so another practical thing we can do that I did with Adam Davis, since you brought it up, it jumped into my mind, was, we developed all these simulation games to see whether in making these payments in sort of a hypothetical arena and game setting, whether the system were well designed enough to be robust to people just trying to beat the system. And we didn't succeed in that. And it points out the importance, for instance, of work on how to design markets effectively to achieve social goals. Not that I think ecosystem service protection should be achieved primarily through markets. It'll be through a lot of other kinds of mechanisms and institutions that hopefully we have better understanding and control of than we often do with markets. But I don't know if you have comments on what to do about all this. These are huge worries you're laying out. I appreciate what you're bringing up, and but I'm hoping that in inching along and in being in intimate communication with people, like even in our China case, for instance, we have a huge social science research project going on with respect to how much people should be compensated for different types of changes in policy, over how land can be used and such. So in the first set of payments that I mentioned when the logging ban was imposed in Yunnan province, people have come to the conclusion that they weren't paying enough. And so, now they want to increase the payment, but they're hoping always to be having these village level surveys going on and among the different ethnic minority groups as well as the Han Chinese and stuff like that, just sort of building into project design all these ways of seeing and checking and getting feedback. But if you brought up a huge topic, so if anybody wants to go further.
You both have strong traditional ways of getting where you are now. We're talking about this, the implications of our work now, which, especially in environmental science, is becoming maybe bigger or different than the role of a science professor has been in the past. Do you think that the role of a professor and how professors should be judged should change, and the sorts of activities that they should pursue and need to pursue and how they pursue them needs to change?
Jump in on that question and add a little bit. One thing I've been wondering about is when do you think that, to the three of you actually, whether the academic community tends to discount some activism or whether it's the mechanisms that lead to success that create that break. Because, Wendy, it sounds like your work has, your activism has been very separate from your actual research. And the two of you have both spoken about your research holding back Claire, you've been doing more research and have been doing the activism, and you took time out, you did activism before you got back to the research.
That interaction, I mean, what a professor should do is what does academia value or take space for?
And just the fact that you're here now, to me, that value is changing. That's kind of...
I'll start assembling my son. I still kind of want to call it, I mean, for me, I don't want to call it activism. I call it practice. Putting into practice conservation science. And I really do think that's different. To me, activism is more, you know, being outspoken about issues, and I don't know, maybe it's really hard, but I don't know whether I feel the academic system necessarily needs to change to value this type of work. I don't know. I have to think about that a lot more. I mean, I think maybe the academic system, it would probably take a lot to get it to change, because if the academic system were to change, then think about all the different disciplines and all the different ways that a discipline could then put their work into practice, and then how would you judge that? Whereas it's fairly easy to judge, you know, papers and journals and stuff like that. So, you know, in part maybe that is why our academic system is the way it is. And the other part of the question was about balancing between the two, I think, or?
Well, I'm a little curious about whether you think that does academia not value that, or is it just hard to do both because the mechanisms for being successful in academia cut out some of that opportunity?
I think that, I mean, I think as an assistant professor, you really are being judged on your productivity in, at least at a lot of institutions, you're being judged on productivity in terms of publications and research grants. And so that, you know, that's the currency that you have to work in. And I do think that limits people. I think that both Gretchen and I have, because we have taken these unusual career paths, I feel like her that I gained a lot of flexibility by not going right into academia. Then I lost a bit of flexibility when I was deciding to go back into academia, but I feel like I'm regaining it again. You know, that I will regain it more, you know, once I do cross the line and actually get tenure, then I would, you know, be able to do these practice things. And I think that, you know, you do continue to be judged in an academic standard. And at, you know, most universities, including Berkeley, you have a service component and a research component and a teaching component. And so you do get judged on service also. It's just not necessarily going to count as much or be as easy to identify as the research component. And it's, I don't know whether it's changing or not. I mean, I don't know. Maybe some of the senior professors here could give their view on, is it changing? Do you think that... the academic institutions are starting to value more when professors, you know, have this sort of practice component that, and also if they, you know, if they allow to sort of inform their research, do you think that gets valued, and has that changed? You guys.
Done both in 30 years. I actually don't think it has changed.
Okay.
I think with the trick, if you want to do it, is you have to have a very strong component of what they expect you to be doing.
Yeah.
And you try to sneak this in as service. I also think that it's critical that this doesn't go against the grain of what the university is. We still got the bar, so we see what we need. We are taking a strong position against what the university sees as a path or an interest. This is very difficult, very costly. But, you know, for 25 years, about 20% of the time I've been doing these kind of things.
Yeah.
You always can tell the letters in the back when you're getting promotion or merit in terms of what they weigh. If 95% of the letter is about your research, maybe a couple percent is about, 3% is about your teaching, and 2% is your service, they put one phrase, and, oh yeah, he works for the World Health Organization. That sort of tells you that it hasn't changed, I think. Please, what do you think?
Well, I just had, I don't know, but the current thing depends on how much money you make from it. But on architect or an engineer or an ophthalmologist and you have practice outside the profession and earn a lot of money, that's considered a good thing because you have to do that in order to stay current with your work. And if you start a new park in Madagascar and didn't get paid $1 billion and win the Golden Prize, it probably makes no difference at all. That's frankly, that makes me sick of my stomach, and the tricky thing is absolutely right in the danger of that process of trying to crush any question on that deal is a real one.
I don't think there's going to be change in the institutions since I've been here. But I think it's important to recognize that it's our lives and we decide how we're going to use them. Make these choices and take the consequences. And the institution does allow them to, but you can't make your own choices. And the second issue that just raised is that the rhythms of academic work and of actual engagement outside are quite different. And so I often think that one of the problems with our difficulty is matching often contrary kinds of demands that emerge in the day-to-day living of these professions. So if you're working on a thing that's politically hot, for example, it's 24 hours a day on a call where there's no respect for the fact that they have to walk in like USA countries. So I find that to be something maybe worth talking about is how people succeed or not in meshing those rather different patterns of demand.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the comments made. You often hear in economics something like progress is made funeral by funeral, and it happens at a glacial pace in academia in general. But at the same time, it's been inspiring to see here, you know, the development of ERG, which I heard about a lot having been here, and then more recently, you know, it's all taking forever, but at Stanford there's, and other many other universities now, much more of a focus on real-world problem-solving and being relevant. And one thing that speaks to the value of academia, even as it is the way Claire and I have sort of both stayed in it in one way or another, is there aren't that many opportunities out in the world. What are you going to go do? Become, what, an ophthalmologist and work on the environment? Or, you know what I mean? It's one of the best arenas that exist for making change, and especially if I've often, the bigger question for me has been whether to give up on academia entirely, and I haven't ever wanted to do that because and that's a neat one, I think, to be asking oneself. That's kind of a major choice you have, is sort of, well, why bother with academia if you're so personally motivated to make change on all the fronts, you know, out in the real world? And academia is wonderful in so many respects, I've ended up concluding, in the way you do have so much freedom and you can make of it what you want. And yeah, take some risks and pay the consequences or whatever, but it is, you know, this is your life, this is it, no dress rehearsal. And so it, to me, has ended up working out really well so far, even though there are a ton of constraints. And then you also have to ask yourself, how much time are you going to spend battling the system? You know, Pam Masson, for instance, I am very grateful to her and admire her tremendously for getting inside the belly of the beast now as a dean and trying to change Stanford, but that would drive me crazy. You know, she's trying to change the world way beyond Stanford, but that's kind of her point of entry, and that's where, again, you have to do what suits you. I still find it a really worthwhile path to be on. I see huge value to staying, keeping doors open, publishing like mad, going to the mat in your basic research, and hopefully you love it. If you don't love the basic work you're doing, whatever it is, by basic I just mean very scholarly, kind of, could be very problem-oriented, I'm not making that distinction. I mean just scholarly work where you're not out trying to necessarily make change in the world and stuff. If you don't love it, then I'd say it's not worth it. You have to really love it. And if you do love it, academia is the place to be, really. It's hard to get this stuff done in an NGO context, typically, I think.
Yeah, I think Gretchen made a really great point about the freedom we have in academia. And because we talked a little bit about not having freedom in certain respects, the need to publish, etc., the need to, you know, you have to have your scholarly agenda to be successful in academia. But there's also tremendous freedom in what you can do, and that, so we should always think about that. And the other thing is that in the NGO world, it's not like you're completely unconstrained there either. You're not at all unconstrained. There's lots of constraints, lots of direction, and there's the funding is always an issue. Even, you know, the funding just to keep your own self going was definitely an issue for me. I had to raise essentially all of my salary for most of the time I was in the NGO world. So you don't really have constraints. I mean, you don't really have total freedom. You're responding maybe to multiple donors and what they want, and there's no ticket that's purely free. So it's a question of deciding which flavor you want, and maybe do you want to be more on the practice side or more on the research side or right in the middle, and how can you get the mix of things that you do want? And I think that in academia, you can create avenues to do both.
I just want to make a quick response to
give the last word.
I think ultimately we just have a certain amount of time in the day, and as PhD students we need to do some research and write a dissertation, and so that's why you guys haven't gotten any emails from me this semester. I had a lot of fun and I felt very fulfilled last semester, but my research went very, very slowly. And so, I mean, I think also as a professor, you just have a lot of pressure to be productive. And I wanted to ask one last burning question to Claire and Gretchen, because I know we're all change makers at heart in ESLM. And for me, I'm just afraid that if I decide to leave academia after my PhD and try the NGO group or try some other group, that I'm going to be disappointing all the people who have been mentors, who have been hoping deep down inside that I would stay in academia. And then, I guess, were you afraid when you left academia that it would be hard to come back?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that as, you know, now I'm in my position as mentor, I'm thrilled that people want to go out and do things that will and not be academics. Because I think that that's part of what we're, you know, trying to train people for. And so, I mean, I think both pathways are great. And I think that when I decided to leave academia, I think that I did feel some guilt. I was actually not even just leaving academia, I was really leaving my own, the field that I was in. And I felt some guilt towards my major advisor. He was really supportive. But it was really pretty clear that most of my professors were kind of like, oh, conservation, well, somebody has to do it. Good, I'm glad you're doing it. But they didn't, I mean, they weren't really terribly happy about it, but they were okay with it. But I think that's really changed. I mean, and especially coming out of this department where, you know, this is our mission, to have a mission of environmental sciences. And what was
the last one? Were you afraid of seeing it when you get back?
Oh, I just left, and I wasn't concerned about it when I decided to make that change. I wanted to do something that meant the most to me, and I didn't know if I would want to come back to academia, and I didn't know that until, you know, till I did decide to make that step. And even, I left my master and came back to Stanford, where I was at the Center for Conservation Biology as a postdoc, but I was still doing a lot of practice stuff at that time, and I made a bunch of applications to get jobs, and, you know, just kept getting rejection, and I kind of let it go and wasn't really going to do it. And then I ended up I just happened to get this job at Princeton, so I went there. And, until the moment when I got the job, I wasn't positive I wanted to go back to academia. This is sort of how my life path went. And now I'm, you know, I think it's great. It's a great place to be. Here.
So I just want to thank everybody very much for the chance to meet today and coming in at 9 a.m. and stuff. So wish you a really good rest of the day and look forward to talking more.